In all seriousness, I'm delighted to be here. And again, my name is Richard Addison. And what I want to do today is start out with a little bit of some brief introductions, just around the room very quickly. But I want to start out to tell you a little bit about myself, how I got here, and what in the world am I doing as a guy named Ridgeway Addison, talking to you about a guy named Howard Thurman at Holden Village as we're leading into the fall. So thinking about doing that, these are some questions you can start to think about, and I'm going to answer them first so we can give you a model, and I want you to know that that they're open-ended. It doesn't have to be geographical. It doesn't have to be regional. It could be a state of mind, right? It can be something phenomenal you just came from, maybe awesome lunch or something else. So thinking on that, this is a little bit about me. So I'm an adjunct assistant professor at Georgetown. I moved up to Washington, D.C. in 1998 to start my PhD at Catholic University of America in religious studies with a concentration in spirituality and spiritual formation. The next year I started working at Georgetown in Protestant chaplaincy and have been there since, serving in various Protestant chaplaincies for the undergraduates and also for the law and medical schools. And I teach classes in spirituality, particularly spiritualities of suffering in the world religions, and also an advanced practice bioethics course for nursing and medical students. And so I really enjoy that work. Thurman is someone that I'm really interested in, though, in terms of Christian spirituality and in terms of mysticism and social change specifically. Other things I think about in terms of who I am, this guy standing up in front of you, I'm also a clergy. I'm a Baptist clergy. I've been ordained for 23 years now, and I spent six of those in various charges of congregational ministry and 12 of those in different academic chaplaincies at Georgetown again. My primary work is as a professor and educator at Georgetown, but I have a little side gig to where I do silent retreats and a little bit of spiritual direction for Dayspring Center, which is a part of the Church of the Savior out of Washington, D.C. If you're familiar with the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation, I was on their board for 6 years and continue to be active in their programming. And I also am on the board currently of the Washington Theological Consortium, which is kind of an ecumenical group of all the theological schools and seminaries up in D.C. trying to work together. They're kind of two purposes, and one of the purposes is to get to know the mind, the heart, the spirit, and to get to know the social setting and also the experience of Thurman in ways that impact your mind, your heart, your spirit, your social setting, your experience, right? And another reason to do that is to, another purpose of the session is to think a little bit, as the title of the larger series suggests, what word might Thurman's work then have to say to our contemporary setting? Not just generally, but from a Christian frame, okay? And so when we think about that, we can think about taking a look at Thurman today, Wednesday and Friday, but we can also think about a mirror, and we can think about, we want to be able to come away each time we're together with a little deeper understanding of our own life, our own time, our own mind, our own spirituality, our own spiritual questions, our own notion of what it means to be for or against Christian discipleship. Because this man was both for and against certain elements of it, as was Luther, I think. So when we think about this, there are three things we're going to talk about this week. Today we're going to talk about Thurman as a spiritual father for social change. Wednesday we'll talk about Howard Thurman among the Quakers and Hindus, kind of his experiments in interreligiosity. And then Friday we'll close with Thurman and the natural world, which is a wonderful place to do this in. If you show up at the others, I might do a little recap of his life, which we're going to start with here, but then we'll get right into it. And you can tell yourselves you're one and done today, right? After 5 minutes, peace out, going hiking, going to take a nap. Or if you come back for the others, come back for any of them. Or if people that you know want to come to the others, they can just show up and we'll catch them up. And each of them is not necessary for the others. But if you come to all three of them, there's a really nice bonus prize. And that's just my eternal appreciation.
Eternal.
Right. So when we think about that, one thing that Martin Marty, who is a well-known American historian, kind of religious historian out of Chicago, said about Thurman when they put together kind of a festschrift to mark 20 years after Thurman's death in 2001. He was commenting in some of the preface materials that for Martin Marty, Thurman was a prophet of his times, but he also was what Martin referred to as a holy man or holy person for the new millennium. A holy person for the new millennium. And so when we think about that, what does it mean to think again about Thurman, 1900 to 1981, right? World wars, depression, American civil rights movement, globalism, the birth of the UN, Vietnam, the space, you know, running to the moon. And what can he say to us as we think about him? And I have introducing and reintroducing, because certainly every time we hear about a historical figure or some sort of religious leader, that's always in a context. Holden Village is the context. All of you as particular individuals here to have discussions as a context. And this guy with this accent as your primary interlocutor. So that's a different context too, right? So I want to apologize for my interpretation of Thurman, but I will tell you a little bit about me. Okay, I haven't published anything significant in terms of a book about Thurman, but I, to my knowledge, am the only non-black who is at that particular level of research and specialty in teaching on Thurman currently. There are about five other people who are still practicing as either academics or kind of social justice organizers that are working on Thurman's work. Walter Fluker is the MLK Professor of Christian Theology and Ethics at Boston University and handles all the archival material up there. Luther Smith was the first to publish on Thurman. He retired about 2 years ago as an emeritus from Emory's Candor School of Theology. Both Fluker and Smith, 12 years ago, were very welcoming of me, not only in terms of being at a Catholic university, but also as a white guy, wanting to not just know about Thurman, but to do some serious study so that I could also be an ambassador for him. So thinking on Thurman, what I want to do for the next maybe 15 minutes is give you a quick overview, because so many of us don't know a lot or don't know anything. And then what I'd like to do after that is give us a chance to get into maybe 5 minutes of some quiet time for yourself to do a little bit of some journaling or reflection on what we heard. And there's some material here to do that. And then after that, we'll take maybe 15 minutes to get into some groups of threes or fours to kind of talk about what you heard in this first bit. We'll take a short break. That's the formal time that if your parents told you you should never leave in the middle of something, you can leave, because I'm actually going to release this for a little bit. And then we'll come back and have a little bit more of a group discussion. And then the last probably 40 minutes of our time together today, I'll offer maybe 15 or 20 minutes more of some focused commentary on Thurman that I know of based on what our questions were. And then I'd like to close with listening to an audio clip of Thurman for about 12 minutes, giving a brief spiritual reflection. So in terms of the essentials, when people think about Thurman, there's certain things that they think about in terms of who he was. First and foremost, people who know Thurman or heard a little bit about him would say Thurman was a minister. Thurman was a minister. Thurman, very early on in his life, in his early college years, felt a call to what he called becoming a religious man, a commitment to becoming a religious man. And so he focused himself as an African-American minister who was a tremendous intellect and a tremendous writer and a tremendous guru. A lot of people wanted to make Thurman a guru as a minister. He never left the organized Christian church. He certainly experimented on the boundaries of what that looked like with some experimental church movements in the 20th century. Other things when people think about Thurman, they think about Thurman as an educator. And here's a picture of Thurman in the 60s in a classroom up at Boston University, sitting back on his desk and laughing about something that one of his students had said. I believe that this is a class about scripture and creative writing. Right? And in terms of educating, one thing I'll tell you quickly, just a little anecdote. When Thurman was on the faculty of the seminary at Boston University, he taught spiritual resources. He also team taught a class on preaching. Well, he team taught it for one semester, and then they agreed they weren't going to work together anymore because their pedagogies were so different. Thurman felt you really couldn't teach someone to preach. He felt that that was something that was kind of innate in them, and they were called to that, and why you could give people skills. The kind of prophetic and church office of that was something that you really couldn't just say everyone coming to seminary should go and get into the pulpit. So one thing that he did was he took his students during one of the two class sessions each week for that semester into the chapel proper. He took a phonograph player, he took some Beethoven, he took some Mozart, he took some gospels and some spirituals. He put them on. He would play about 3 minutes of one while one of the students was up in the pulpit. He would pull the needle up. He would give them a text. He would give them 3 minutes to prepare a sermon extemporaneously, and then they would go. So he certainly was involved in contemplative or experiential pedagogy, as well as being a great mind as well to have philosophical debate with. Also, when we think about Thurman, anyone ever heard of this quote before? Seen it on a magnet, on a bumper sticker, you know, on a guitar case, right? Yeah, so Thurman, this is Thurman's, right? This is Thurman's. And this is not in a published text of his. This was this came in correspondence to one of his rabbi friends on the West Coast when they were talking about the ideas of vocation and thinking about deciding about how this young rabbi would pursue work either in a synagogue setting or in kind of a social justice or educational setting, right? That's something I think most people can get behind, right? When we think about Thurman, we think about him as an author, not just an author, but as a wordsmith. Thurman felt that while he published 22 books by the time of his death and also edited a collection of a South African poet's poetry, he felt that his gift, his penchant, had always been for the spoken word. And so the written word always came later for him, but he certainly was prolific in terms of being a wordsmith and an author. What people also think about for the essentials of Thurman is when they think about Thurman, they think about him as a preacher. When they think about him as a preacher, they can say that in the 50s, Time magazine, when they were doing their list, named him as one of the most important or relevant 12 preachers in the United States. And during that time, Thurman never gave altar calls, never whooped, you know, had call and response like a typical kind of charismatic or black church would. Thurman was likely the most contemplative, slow, caramel-worded... gestating preachers that you would have heard. And so we didn't start by listening to one of his things today because I didn't want everyone to go to sleep right away, right? But this is an image from the from Rankin Chapel at Howard University and the Divinity School. And this is one of Thurman and two others who followed him in terms of thinking about his work. And I offer this that rather than a picture of him in the pulpit because it's a stained glass and you're able to see the light through it. And of course, there's a lot of theological symbolism in the stained glass. And Thurman said as a religious man that he always felt that a word was being spoken through him and that his commitment as he grew through his life and his education was to get out of the way of that word so we could kind of come through him more clearly. And he said even in his late 70s that he felt like that three-fourths of the time that he wasn't getting it right. So someone who was named in the prime of his career as one of the 12 most effective or popular preachers of the Christian message in America by Time, is saying in his retirement he still is not getting it right. And when we think about Thurman also, this is another one of the things that we know a lot but maybe not enough about. Spiritual father and architect of the American Civil Rights Movement. I'll tell you a little bit about Martin King Jr.'s briefcase and a little bit of a true anecdote there in a moment. Thurman was at the March on Washington. He was not up front with King or with Abraham Joshua Heschel or any of the others kind of getting their pictures made. But Thurman was there, and the most important part of the march for Thurman was his attention that he gave to the young African-American college students who gathered together and the boisterous, joyful singing that they did of the slave spirituals as well as a lot of the social justice songs of that time. Another thing about Thurman in terms of essentials, think about him being the first African-American intellectual, religious intellectual, to share conference with Gandhi. Talk a little bit about when that happened. He and Gandhi sat down with Sue Bailey. She's over here on the left, Sue Bailey Thurman. This was Thurman's second wife. His first wife died prematurely of tuberculosis when they were first married. But this was during the 1930s, during a YMCA-sponsored pilgrimage of friendship to India and to Burma and Ceylon. So this is an image. They just finished the conference and they're walking out. I'll tell you more about that later. What sticks with people about Howard Thurman? Or what do people remember most about Howard Thurman? Well, this guy. Right, this guy. Well, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you the story now because I can't wait because I already got you intrigued. So this is a true statement. That for the majority of Dr. King's work, when he kind of took the mantle formally of being the social agitator, the mouthpiece, the primary persona leading the American Civil Rights Movement after he got out of the workers' movement down in the South, and that got involved with the more full-on racial issue domestically and regionally in the United States. He would carry a briefcase with him. He had the Bible in there. He sometimes would have Tolstoy's The Kingdom of God is Within Us. But one book that he always had with him was Thurman's text from the late 1940s, Jesus and the Disinherited. And what's interesting about that is that he did not look to that book for strategic points only to talk about in his speeches or to frame his social activism organization. King used that thin but very seminal Thurman text as his own devotional centering and inspirational things to read again and again while he was in that metaphorical green room, and then his handlers would say, they're ready for you. So Thurman's book was what King went to on the trail for inspiration right before he went out to speak to the masses. Right? What else is essential, or why do people remember? What do we have here? Another stained glass image of some of the world's wisdom or religious traditions. In the middle is a lamp. So this is kind of a notion of a pluralism or kind of an interoperability among the world religion traditions. And so Thurman certainly himself was interracial, and also very concerned about interfaith. These things both were his strengths in terms of my interest in him, but also some things that got him critiques from some of his own black colleagues, some of his own Christian colleagues, and also from a lot of his academic colleagues. Other things that people remember about Thurman. His childhood and adolescence. Thurman was born in 1900 in a black ghetto called Waycross, one of three right outside of Dayton and Dayton Beach. And we'll talk a little bit more about this, especially on Friday with Thurman and the Natural World. But in terms of his own religious experience and his sense of who God was, a local Baptist church, but also even more the world of nature and the wilderness around him, really formed his sense of identity, his sense of the divine presence. He especially would love to go down to the Atlantic Ocean, not when it was calm, but at night when storms were coming. And he would love to put his feet in the water to feel the wind come up on him and to kind of feel this sense of wildness. Thurman himself was a very darkly pigmented black man, more dark than the majority of children that he grew up with in Waycross. There's also speculation that his father, Saul Thurman, who he names as his father in his autobiography, was not his biological father, and that this was a truth that he held with himself until his death in terms of honoring his mother and not causing her more difficulty. So if you can think about the idea of a child who's already maybe by gossip excluded in a ghetto, who also was pigeon-toed, and so as he got into adolescence and was playing more and more sports and throwing more rocks at dogs and trying to run away from them with his friends, was always the last one picked for the team and always the first one that the dogs got because he couldn't run as well. Thurman says that being held by a sense of nature, he talked about being understood in this climate of being at the ocean. He said he felt held and he felt understood in ways that even his most closest positive family relationships didn't allow for him. So if you want to know about Thurman's mysticism, if you want to know about Thurman and kind of this universal love and presence of God, go back and read his biography about his early childhood nature experiences. A couple of the things that people remember about Thurman. Deep is the Hunger, a collection of some of his centering pieces. The piece I read this morning at breakfast was out of The Inward Journey, which was the third of three collections of these. And I call them centering pieces because that's what he called them. When he was the chaplain, dean of the chapel at Howard University, and also did some similar work at Spelman before that, and then the Fellowship Church co-founder in San Francisco, and then closed his career at Boston University. About an hour before the Sunday services would start, he would open the sanctuary. All the musicians had to have been finished rehearsing. There was no gossip. There was no setting up things. There was no primping the flowers and then catching up with, how are you doing? And what's going on? And oh, good to see you. And praying for you. But it was supposed to be an hour of quiet. And on the back of the order of service, he would write a 2 to 4 or 5 paragraph piece each week reflecting from a spiritual view on the events of that week domestically and globally. And so the piece I read this morning about reacting to the atom bomb, about American shame, about recovering from the World War, that would be something that you just don't read on your own at Holden, but you read that silently, not intentionally talking and gossiping with others before you worship. And so he collected these in three volumes. Deep Into the Hunger was the first one. And what he called the people at the Fellowship Church who wrote this first one was for, was he called them apostles of sensitiveness. Apostles of sensitiveness. And for Thurman, you want to be sensitive. You want to be intimately aware. That's almost the height, the first call and the final step of what true authentic religiosity means, that you're sensitive and you're aware of life and life's going on. And so his devotional and meditative writings certainly are the first thing that people remember in a lot of ways. I'll confess, this was one of the things that initially threw me off of him, and I almost thought about not writing on him. I had gone to Catholic University of America to do my PhD because they had a special focus on spirituality at that time, not in psychology and religion, but in kind of a confessional liturgical way that I could do it with religious studies too. I went there thinking about Thomas Merton. You might have heard of him. I realized there was a dearth of literature written about him, and I didn't want to have to take on too much to read. I wanted to get the dissertation done before I got to be an advanced paternal aged dad. I also thought about writing on the German lyric poet Rainer Rilke, but one of the challenges there was the dean that I was going to work with died prematurely, and so I didn't get a chance to formulate a concept with him. But I had known Thurman because I read him first in a systematic class in seminary. Only read Jesus and the Disinherited, though. Didn't know about this devotional, kind of meditative, kind of Richard Rorian or Annie Dillard kind of style. Mm-hmm. Well, beautiful stuff until you get to the very end of some of these centering pieces, to where he closes with a formal prayer. And I got to tell you, some of his language really turned me off, because Thurman was writing as a person of his era, paternalistically, male-dominated images, but also King James kind of thou and thee and thus and all this in the way he would close the prayer, right? And I was like, oh, I can't do that. I'll just go write on Carl Rahner or someone else, or, you know, thought about the Urban Holmes as Episcopal dean. But then I kept coming back to Thurman because I read more deeply. And what I loved was where the words would take you if you could kind of focus on them in that contemplative way rather than the scholarly analysis. So those are some things about Thurman. These are his primary text. I say primary, not for me necessarily, but for people who study him in his context of being a black theologian, being a public intellectual, whose primary contribution was to a spirituality for those with their backs against the wall, primarily men and women, religious communities growing up in the segregated Jim Crow South. Jesus and the Disinherited was the first that he published. Seminal text that King carried in his briefcase. Deep as the Hunger was this first collection of centering pieces that I mentioned. Those are probably the two most well-known on these four. The Luminous Darkness, if you're interested, the subtitle of this is A Personal Analysis of the Grounds of Segregation and of Hope. And so he's doing some social analysis of segregation from his own biographical view, but also thinking about it in terms of how the Christian church failed in the South. This is something that you could read alongside King's letter from a Birmingham jail and get a little bit of perspective to see where they have cross channels or cross influences. And then Deep River, the Negro Spiritual Speaks of Life and Death, Ingersoll lectures that Thurman gave in the 1973. He took as his text not a great philosophical tome, not a great American piece of constitutional law, but he took the slave spirituals. And what he did was he didn't interpret them only for blacks to say, you know, to the larger consciousness of whites and blacks who are reading his work, feel guilty, feel ashamed, feel stymied. But he looked at them as a way of talking about the universal human experience of trying to find an imaginative way out, first in your inward life, out of politically and culturally limiting situations. And so Jacob's Ladder, Deep River, Were You There? He looked at those historically from an African-American perspective, but he opened them up to a larger issue for Americans who are reading and thinking about a way of getting out of a desperate or kind of tight situation where culturally and spiritually you felt limited to be fully human and to be free. And look when he was writing those, early 1970s. So what are we coming out of there, right? Still out of Vietnam, thinking about what's going on in the Middle East and America during that time. Other work that he worked on, I introduced these because these first two are well known, and I think these two speak most beyond Jesus and Disinherited about his focus on black theology or Christianity, responding to and dealing with segregation and racism. When we think about Thurman's life, I will keep this up here all week, and what I probably will do too is maybe take a picture of it and make some copies. And I'm sorry that I used the cool font of my own handwriting here, but this is a little bit of an overview. I've just mentioned really quickly here, in terms of seeking a homeland, Thurman grew up in this black ghetto, again, outside of Daytona and Daytona Beach. And the thing that we remember about Thurman's childhood the most is that he was really formed primarily by the world of nature, and he was really formed primarily by his maternal grandmother, Nancy Ambrose. She was called Lady Nancy at the church, Mount Bethel Baptist, where they all went back in Waycross. And Thurman grew up with two older sisters, and so Thurman was kind of mothered in a lot of ways. And Thurman's father, or assumed father, Saul Thurman, was a railroad man and often away from the home for 3 weeks to 2 months at a time, helping to lay track and repair things. And so Thurman grew up as kind of the man or the only male in the house in this community. He grew up in a community to where the primary religious segregation in Waycross was between Methodist and Baptist. And he said that that was a pretty strong division because the kids, as they got into adolescence, would start to pick up on the adult theological arguments, and they would have arguments about what type of baptism really counted and who was going to be saved and who wasn't. Another quick thing to say about his homeland experience was that for Thurman, the church was a difficult place that he came out of in a positive way to be one of the pioneering church people of the 20th century. Talked about Saul Thurman, his father. Saul Thurman, unlike his mother Alice and his grandmother Nancy, was not a man of the church, was not a regular believer in Jesus, a participator in worship. As a Baptist church, you know, open Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, you know, probably a committee meeting some other time. He wasn't there even for Christmas, right? So he was not one there. But he had an inner life. When he died, when Thurman was almost a teenager, his mother wanted him to be her husband to be buried from the church. The pastor refused it. So Lady Nancy, the informal leader of the church, walked up there and said, Saul will be buried from this church. And the pastor said, well, he will be, but I won't be doing the funeral. And so they were able to contract with Sam Cromarty, who was an itinerant Jack-led preacher at the time. And what Reverend Cromarty did was he took the opportunity of leveraging the eulogy to preach Saul Thurman into hell as an example for everyone there to need to convert and to become a Christian. And so as that was happening, Thurman writes in his autobiography that he felt his mother's hand on his knee as those words were coming out of the preacher's mouth, and her hand tightened on his leg, and he leaned into her and started crying and said, you know, he didn't know Daddy. You know, he didn't know Daddy. And he said a couple weeks later that he committed to himself that as he grew up, and this is funny because our daughter Magdalene says, maybe when I grow up, I'm going to do this. You know, we talk about like a big bike or bike with that friend goes in. Well, maybe when I'm a big girl, I can get my own watch. You know, maybe I'm right. Well, Thurman said back then as almost a teenager, when I grow up, if I have anything to do with it, I'll have nothing to do with the church because of that. Well, later on, he got still a little bit of interest, and he wanted to be baptized. And again, in the Free Church tradition, that's not something that's brought up with children, or there's not for a confirmation process. They had a particular formation process of having some older members of the church mentor anyone in Mount Bethel Baptist to be baptized, but they needed to have a period of preparation. Well, Thurman went before the deacon board one time to kind of talk about his confession and tell his kind of story of salvation. Well, the deacon board listened. And they said to him, you know, Mr. Thurman, or young Master Thurman, we believe that we will continue to pray for you, but we want you to go back home and we will not baptize you. And he had told his understanding of Jesus and his notion of God in language that he understood. Guess what? Lady Nancy marched him back to that church and said, "This boy will be baptized." And about 2 months later, after being mentored by an older couple, Thurman was brought into the church and baptized. This, for me, tells an important early warning sign for Thurman in language and religious experience, because he probably spoke very caringly and very prayerfully about what he experienced of God in being brought up in the church by his mother and his grandmother, right? Very faithful leaders. But there was this litmus test of either certain scriptures or certain phrases, and he didn't pass that. And later on in Thurman's work, both as being qualified as a mystic, being qualified as a contemplative, being qualified even more as a Christian, they continued to be a litmus test throughout his life that certain people said he would not pass. So gaining education, first black male of his generation to pass the 7th grade competency exam. So then he was able to go on and pass the 8th grade competency exam. Trouble is, there was an 8th grade in Waycross. So the principal of the primary school tutored him himself. He passed that one, and then he earned a full scholarship to Jacksonville Baptist Academy in Jacksonville, Florida for 9th through 12th grade. This is going to get old. Okay? Graduated as valedictorian, okay? Was promised by both a doctor and a businessman from his home community that if he would study medicine or he would study business, they would pay his complete way through. He went to Morehouse College to be one of the Morehouse men, started working on business and economics. After his first year of study, he focused on philosophy of religion and biblical studies. And he began to see early on in that second year of college that he felt a call to be in the ministry, and to give himself to that. And he graduated Morehouse, valedictorian. And the rumor is that he read every volume in Morehouse's library. And he also was an editor, I think, of the school newspaper then. Wanted to go to, I think it was Gordon Conwell, or to Andover Newton, sorry, in Boston, Massachusetts, for his seminary. But during that time, they did not have space or allow blacks to register. And so he was one of two African-Americans that went the next year, I believe in 1923, to Colgate Rochester up in Rochester, New York. And the things to mention here briefly about Morehouse and about his time at Colgate Rochester. At Morehouse, strangely enough, kind of a historically black school, Mordecai Johnson was there in leadership, Benjamin Ways was there in leadership and in teaching. These were two significant people in terms of informal and formal leadership of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference later on. But it was during his time at Morehouse that Thurman was introduced to the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is generally known as a primarily white, very liberal, Protestant-based international movement for peace at the local, regional, national, and cosmic level. Thurman really liked their notion of nonviolence in terms of not supporting war, activating against war, supporting conscientious objection. But Thurman felt that he really wasn't about that level of peace. He was more concerned about it on the daily personal realm. And he would write in his autobiography, the fact that certain men and women were spending their lives and doing their training and giving their leadership to this large, systemic, universal, institutional organization of combating violence and waging peace at that level, that comforted him in a way to know that he could find his own way to be the peacemaker he wanted to be without needing to be about disarmament only, without needing to be a community organizer, without needing to be, you know, an activist, right? When he was at Colgate Rochester, which was a school way up again in Rochester, New York, one of two black students there, and he got himself and one of his roommates kicked out the first year because he had met a couple white students at the orientation, and they decided they were going to room together. What's wrong with that? Well, some of the administration allowed it, but they weren't ready for it, and so they initially threatened to expel them both. It was during a time of a student-driven and student-led retreat that he came to know one of the primary literary and kind of symbolic mentors of his life, the South African female poet Olive Schreiner. Thurman, toward the end of his life, edited a collection of her poems called A Track to the Water's Edge. He named his first daughter after her, Olive, And so Olive Schreiner is someone who wrote a lot about utopic imagery, using a lot of nature, using a lot of images of people in kind of rural settings, and you can certainly see that in Thurman's own work later. Launching a career after seminary, he went and was in a parish for about 3 or 4 years in Oberlin Baptist Parish. What was interesting there was I think he knew about 2 years in that he was done with parish ministry for a long-term vocation. So he went, as some of you who might know ministry or know lay leadership in the church, to a training conference, a regional training conference, right? He went there. Well, after hearing a couple of the speakers, he was kind of done for the day, and he was going to ease out early, but he decided to stop by the bookshop, right? Well, he picked up a book by the American Quaker Rufus Jones, probably one of the most two or three well-known Quaker philosopher religions in the 20th century, and it was called Finding the Trail of Life, or Finding the Trail of My Life. And Thurman says, and again, he has a little bit of some embellishments in his autobiography, I sat down on the steps of that church and read that book from start to finish, and then as I drove home, I knew that if it was in my power, I wanted to study with this man. And so Thurman had just married his first wife, Kate Kelly, as they moved to Oberlin, and during this time, about 8 months after their daughter Olive was born, she contracted tuberculosis and did not recover and had to go back down to Georgia to convalesce with her family. So Thurman had started actually a term at Haverford studying with Rufus Jones, and he was studying with Rufus Jones some of the mystics, Meister Eckhart, Francis of Assisi, Bonaventure, but he was also looking at some of the Quaker writings and experiences of George Fox, John Woolman, and the contemporary Thomas Kelly at that time, thinking about his work. Because of the death of and the dying of his first wife, he had to wrap up that study prematurely, and he was left in a lot of grief because of that. He took a sabbatical to go to England and Scotland, took a boat ride by himself. His in-laws cared for his daughter, but he was away for about 2 months to grieve and think about what would be next. One thing that's important to note about his time with Rufus Jones on the liberal Protestant kind of blind spot side of things, one thing we can think about with Thurman is his life is a good example of where even well-intentioned white Christians can actually do the worst work. It's better to sometimes have someone who's against you than someone who's for you in the wrong way. He said that Rufus Jones was a good mentor for him, and that both Jones and a couple of his professors at Colgate Rochester were actually preparing him for an academic career. They felt like he had great promise and would be a great leader. He felt after about 3 months of studying with Jones that it was settled in his mind that he did not want to pursue a PhD. He said he felt that the energy that he would need to give to the academic pursuit of religion would make anemic the resources he wanted to provide to the interior life, to the soul, to kind of the experience of God. So Jones was okay with that. He still felt like he should be an academic, and they prepared a mentor for him. One of the flaws, though, for Jones that Thurman talks about is he says that for Jones, he was colorblind. And what he means by that is because they both were living at this kind of monism or kind of unity of life from a mystical point of view that all is one and all are equal and God is in everything, that in some ways social context or social location didn't matter. And so for Thurman, he felt that Jones saw that he was black and knew that he was white, but that he had this kind of transcendental view of God in everything and everything equal in God. And so he didn't really give mind to the social context that Thurman was still in, being limited as a black man in 20th century America. Right? And so this ivory tower kind of font of mysticism and religious experience view, which ultimately fed Thurman's critique of social change, blinded Jones to the differences that Thurman had to have in the real world of a segregated America. As he discerned a profession, he finally found his niche, I think, or his niche, which was being an academic chaplain and a dean of a chapel to where he could teach some and really affect young men and women, the first part of his career at black schools. And then he moved out in 1944 to San Francisco to help co-found and co-pastor a Fellowship of Reconciliation church called the Fellowship Church, or the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples. One of the first, maybe five, interracial congregations of this level with this much funding and this much fellowship attention during the middle of the 20th century. Here's a little story about Thurman here. Two children at this time. He married Sue Bailey when he went to Howard, who he had known during his Morehouse times as a student. And she was also good friends with Kate, and so there was an easy way for them to connect. They had another daughter, Anne. So he had Olive with Kate and Anne with Sue. And during the time that they were at Howard, this is something quick to say too, the YMCA took the two of them and another black young couple on a friendship pilgrimage to internationally. And this is where he first met Gandhi and also at a conference with the Indian poet and educator Tagore. But the interesting thing I want to tell you about the Church of Fellowship for All Peoples is Thurman was coming back to Howard after his pilgrimage. And Alfred Fisk, a Presbyterian progressive clergyman who is a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, said, "Dr. Thurman, we're so glad you're back. We're getting this thing going. We hope it's going to be an experimental, successful church. Is there a young student of yours in the seminary or working in a religious context that you think you could send out here to work with me for a couple of years to kind of get the church going? You know, we can't pay much. There's not a lot of stability here. Do you have anyone to suggest?" Well, over supper that night, Thurman said to Sue, "I think I would like that job. I think I would like to go be a part of that experiment," right? And Sue was probably like saying, "Well, how much are they not going to pay us? And what's the little room above whatever we're going to be living in with our daughters?" Right? But the nice thing, Thurman and Sue called each other their partners at the gate. And they really felt that intellectually and actively they had met their match and their companion for life. And so they saw this as a great new adventure. And he was out there for almost a decade. He helped to co-pastor the church. And then after a couple of years, he took over as the primary pastor. And the church is still there, it's still active, and it still is a great witness for him in California. My regret is they're not able to do more nationally in terms of teaching and staging for organizing, and I think that mainly has an issue to do with fundraising these days. Because San Francisco, as you know, for better and for worse, is a hotbed for progressive, experiential, kind of mystic-based Christianity. Okay. Closed out his career at Boston University. And during this time, he had some overlap or convergence with Martin Luther King Jr., who was there doing his PhD. And then finally, Thurman spent his retirement in California and started the Howard Thurman Educational Trust. Two things that they did, provided scholarship for minority students who were in need, both financially and in terms of cultural support to college and other higher education. And another thing that they did was they helped to fund and create listening rooms. And listening rooms were these rooms that were set up in churches and civic centers that had collections of Thurman's audio tapes, as well as some transcribed transcriptions and audio tapes of other period people who spoke about the inner life and social change. And so, you know, if it had been easier to get it up here, I'm sure that there might have been, if the right connection, a Thurman listening room here at Holden, right? So thinking about that. And thinking about finding community, community is a metaphor that's really vital for Thurman in terms of his overall thought. I don't want to get into it today. I'm more interested in an overview of him historically to get into civil rights, but we'll be talking on community a little bit more Wednesday and Friday. Thurman died at 81 after about a five-year on-and-off struggle with cancer. He did not die of cancer, but that certainly weakened him as he was struggling with that. So when we think about Thurman among his peers, one thing we can think about in terms of what's of worth or interest for him is, as I mentioned, he was a gifted rhetorician, certainly no doubt. And in terms of thinking about his other work, Jesse Jackson, that one, Rainbow Coalition, called him an activator of activists. He said that really was Thurman's gift, right? Not someone to get you amped up to go out there and burn out, but to activate you from the inside and to give you this kind of spiritual center and this spiritual power to know how to kind of pace yourself in that long, patient work of social change and social agitation. My argument in some of my dissertation work is that Thurman was central to, but not at the center of any of the movements or groups that he was a part of. That's why we often don't hear about him as much. But without Thurman, there would not have been the American Civil Rights Movement we know today. Without Thurman, there would not have been the important interracial work that the Fellowship of Reconciliation did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He did not serve on the board, but he served as an informal consultant, and he let them use a lot of his writings free of charge until his death. Also, in terms of thinking about being central but not at the center, Thurman felt that his Negro idiom, as he called it, was vital to his identity and to his context of religiosity, but it did not exclusively identify him. And so there were even those in the black church, both academics and church leaders, who felt that Thurman deserted them because he was interested in seeing about reconciliation with others rather than primarily among his own people and getting their rights established above others. So again, even in the black church, he was central but not at the center and had some critics. Because of that, I argue that he was everywhere with the Quakers, with the Hindus, with Olive Schreiner, the South African poet, with the Baptists, with the academics, with the pastors, with the students instead of the leaders at the march. So because he was everywhere, sometimes he didn't really have a place. He didn't really have a community that really understood him. So he was nowhere in some ways. And I would also say he was an enigmatic Christian. And I have Christian in quotes because Thurman said about halfway through his career, when someone was identifying him as, you know, this great preacher of the Christian word, Time magazine and other places, Christian, who calls me Christian? Because he wanted to be very clear about how that was defined. Right? Because he felt like that we can use that term to kind of, not necessarily desacralize, but sanitize a lot of the real life-changing work of Jesus. And if we institutionalize and dogmatize, we can sterilize that sting of what it means to be really converted. And so he wanted to define Christianity for himself whenever people would talk about him. Okay. So when we think about that, why Thurman for me? I think I've told you a little bit about why Thurman for me so far. Another reason why Thurman for me, briefly, is when I was going to my program directors at Catholic during my course of study and thinking about a dissertation topic, I went to them and I said, Thomas Merton. And this Benedictine who studies psychology of religion and knew Merton himself said, well, why do you want to study Thomas Merton? You know, you're Baptist. He was Catholic. You know, who's going to really want to hire you? Or who's going to really want to, you know, how's the translation? And I'm like, man, I'm not here just for a job. That I'm interested in this. I says, well, how about Rainer Rilke, this German lyric poet? He said, why do you want to study him? He's German, not really theological, maybe spiritual, you know, be a literary, maybe a literature place. You'd be over in that department with Doug or something. And I said, no. How about Urban Holmes, this 20th century Episcopal educator and dean? No, well, you're certainly not Episcopal. You know, they're not going to hire you, whatever. And then when I went, I said, Thurman, the same guy said, well, he's Baptist. And he didn't come out and say this, but he kind of said, well, he's black, and you're not. And that wasn't a racial thing so much as a, how are you going to get a job if you want to be a faculty, being a Thurman specialist as a white guy? And what this professor of mine didn't get was that all of those men, and I wanted to write on a man because that was a mentor for me, cared deeply about the academic life in a way that had practical applications for the real world, and saw this profound unity between the contemplative interior life and political activism and social change. And what was the key for all of them too was the moral imagination. So guess what? William Barbieri, moral theologian and ethicist on the faculty, who I TA'd for, took me over, directed my dissertation, praise be to God. He gave me permission, and I had to make a case for Thurman to the people who I studied under at Catholic, because they, like so many of you, had not heard much of him, and if they heard of him, didn't think of him as a serious theological person. So what happened? The dean at the time encouraged me, gave me permission to write my proposal on him, and then Emerson Crawford, emeritus preaching professor at Howard University, who knew Thurman and followed him as a chaplain when Thurman left, was still living at the time. he served on my dissertation proposal committee. Oh. So I had done my homework on Thurman, and here comes Emerson Crawford to sit by me, the only non-white in the room. And when my liturgical professor or my spirituality professor said, well, I'm not sure about that or whatever, Emerson said, actually, that was a phrase that Thurman himself used. So young Mr. Addison here, right? So again, even in the academy, someone who's known, not always welcome. So I loved him because, again, the great mind focused on practical application of spirituality in the real world, great integration of the interior and the political activism life, and a profound religious imagination, profound moral imagination. So when we think about that, what I wanted to do briefly was give you just a chance to think about a couple questions for maybe 3 or 5 minutes yourself. If you want to just reflect in your head, there's some writing things if you want to use some of that scratch paper. And then I'll invite us after 3 or 5 minutes to get into some groups of 4 or 5 just to discuss it. And here are the questions to think about. What are you most curious about or drawn to about Thurman, either before you came in or thus far today? And then what do you think about the overlap between his personal and professional experiences that I've just highlighted here? And then finally, this is a little bit of a crossover in your own life. Who are other people that you've read or you've known that you think would resonate with Thurman? Right? These could be people you've read about or studied, or maybe people that are in your life now. Maybe some parallels in how they approach religion or politics or race. Look at these questions together or anything else. But what else is like, is something else in between these questions? Is something else you just want to talk about with your folks, right? What I want to do to get us out of here, on time, is to just hear just little snippets. Okay, we could spend the whole time on this, but what I want to do is close out with maybe a couple final thoughts from me and to listen to a brief one of Thurman's talks, because I want to send you on the way with the man himself. So anything worthwhile or of note that came up in your group you want to share with the larger group, if it's just a question or a wondering you have? Anybody, any of these, any feedback from the group briefly?
Mary. All three of them we answered along the same plane of, you know, where was his element of doubt in his, between his youth and his adulthood, of having had a real tough time, and then to lose a wife at a very early age. I mean, there had to be a transitional time, I would think, of maybe anger or no faith whatsoever, I wonder. And then, of course, to become the Christian leader that he did.
Okay, yeah, good question. Yeah. Any other groups? Yeah.
Well, I just reflected just a minute ago on the wondering who, and we put it in a larger context, but who were some of the other fairly influential people of his time that he may or may not have interacted or met? For instance, John Kennedy. I mean, I wonder, that was a wondering I had. Mm-hmm. Did Thurman ever interact with him or others that were in situations political office such as him? And it, you know, in one thought, Kennedy in his own way was an individual that looked at it. It was in a lesser realm in some ways, trying to enact change. In that time of our country's history, and so I was just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions or comments from your group? Yeah.
Yeah, our group felt that he had a greater vision beyond just what was happening day to day. He was aware and concerned himself with a bigger picture.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think so, yeah. I'll just respond briefly to those, and then I'll give you a couple more little bits, and then we'll listen to him. I think that was part of his strength, and I think that's why I got him a little bit misunderstood, as I was mentioning to this group here. When he was finishing up his work at Morehouse and was really kind of gaining some national notoriety as an orator and as a mind, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and kind of what would become the ground roots of the NAACP in the South had said about him, he's the next leader. He's going to take us to the next place. And then he started experimenting more with this liturgy and this contemplation and these centering pieces. So one of those esteemed leaders said, "We thought we had found our new Moses until he went mystic on us." So they were angered with him clinging to what he felt was his true call. They thought they could really not ride him negatively, but he was going to be a demonstrable leader, right? And I think the vision there is what got him frustrated with some of the black community too. You know, we only have 3 sessions, only 2 hours, and we get out here for the whole summer, and you know, the scholars here, right? But Thurman was deeply involved in his black idiom, and he was always rooted there. But he felt that his work was to go beyond that, because he felt like the will of God was beyond that, even for his time. And then when we think about the idea of Kennedy, I can say that the closest presidential family that he had the greatest ties to in his career was with the Roosevelts. That she was particularly a fan of his work, and so there are a couple pictures in the archives of them and a couple letters back and forth, and a couple things too I can say relative to Kennedy and to King is that he was asked for King to eulogize King on the night that he was assassinated on several national radio addresses, and he was also asked by a good number of members of Congress to do some speaking and writing on Kennedy's death as well when that happened.
Oh. Yeah. And did he?
He did. He did. And there's some audio and transcripts of those.
I'm curious, did he have any interaction with Robert Kennedy?
Very little. In terms of just maybe meeting at a reception or something.
Do you know if he happened to have any interaction with Bonhoeffer when Bonhoeffer was here in the United States? Because they were contemporaries at about the same time he was evolving in his theology.
I don't know exhaustively, but I have not been able to find any places where they're together or letters, right?
Okay.
Yeah. There's more to look through, but there was never a place to where there were, that I know of a time they met.
Okay.
Yep. You know, where was his doubt, or where was that tension and stuff, okay? So I mentioned that Thurman was in the hospital, dealt with cancer a lot during the last few years of his life, on and on for 5 or 6 years. And during some of those times, he was hospitalized for some time for some treatment. And there was a recording I found when I was doing my initial dissertation research of him talking, giving a sermon and kind of a talk about a recollection he had when he was in the hospital. And some people would say that I had some conversations with other scholars about this. And he recalled when he was in a hospital that was literally in California, but he had been under medication and was kind of, you know, toward the end of life, and imagined himself back at the hospital in Daytona. So somehow he had gone back to his childhood when he was coming out of some medication or something. And one thing we'll talk about when we talk about the natural order is Thurman's notion that the God of life is also the God of history. And so there shouldn't be also any real segregation about unity and community among the created order and culture, right? But he said he always had 2 fundamental questions. And one was, what was the difference fundamentally between male and female? And before The March of the Penguins came out, and we learned about the emperor penguin and the male carrying, right? Thurman was a big fan of that equal sharing, right? And as in his later life, he learned to oil paint as a pastime, and he painted penguins all the time. But he wondered that question. And the other fundamental question, of course, was what is the real difference or the real significance between the different races? Mm-hmm. And he said he reflected on that question in that vision or that kind of experience of meditation in the hospital. And he said he knew he was coming toward the end. And he said, "I promised the God of life that I would come to find you when I die. And I want to know if the God of life, and you know, the God of the Creator, is also the God of history." Yeah. And that if you are, what was the fundamental reason that there were different races? You know? And that if you don't have a suitable answer for me for that, I will continue to track you down It wasn't a threat as so much as what he was coming up on. And this is not in even some of his, this is in none of his published materials. And in some of, he has, there are three volumes of his letters now that have been published. There's a little bit more to do. There's not a lot that's explicit there, Mary. But for me, and I wrote about this in my own work, that is his unresolved issue of the experience of rejection and exclusion of being a black man during his time period. Because he was saying, if there is a significant reason, you know, it's basically, God, it better be rational, it better make sense. And if there's not a significant reason, my thought was he's saying, then why the hell have I and others had to go through this suffering? You know, why, if there's not a significant reason, God, then why the hell have you made so many of us who are non-white have to go through this suffering? And another quick thing just to mention about Thurman, and then we'll listen to him as we close. He wrestled with nonviolence throughout his whole life. He had more time, we could talk about the nonviolent imperative of the mystical experience, which is, it's not just the idea of belonging and getting along, but there's also the idea of really gentleness and reconciliation and being at one with everything. And as a young man, some of his odd jobs were working at a fish market. He also had chickens and stuff in his family, and he'd have to go out, you know, get the chicken and wring the chicken's neck and stuff. And he said as he got older, it was harder and harder for him to do that because he knew he needed to eat, but he knew this was a creature too, and he didn't know what to do and stuff, you know. And he experimented with vegetarianism. He never adopted it. There was one period when he was on a lecture tour during his time at Howard, and he was kind of in the Pennsylvania, mid-Atlantic area, and he was at another historically black kind of gathering. He was staying at the home of the president of that organization, and it wasn't just that Thurman was coming, but there was some other thing going on there socially to where there was a threat that some Klan movement was going to come through and interrupt it and really make chaos at this school or this institution. And the president told Thurman that. This was his house on the property. And Thurman was there by himself. It wasn't the family. The president and his family were there. And he said when they went to bed that night that the president sat by the front door with his shotgun and that he sent Thurman upstairs to be in the window to be a lookout with the shotgun. And that Thurman was not a man who had guns or really was familiar with guns, but he knew how to fire one. And he said that in his writing, he said he waited by that window all night. And he wasn't sure if they came what he would do.
Yeah.
And they never came. But you know, you just you wonder about that in terms of principle and you know all that. And the other thing about the nonviolence, kind of funny with the chickens, at Boston University he loved having lobster, and he loved having kind of the lobster from that neck of the woods. And George McKenzie was a phenomenal leader at Boston, a white man that he had a significant relationship with. It was a real anchor of his time there. And when I interviewed McKenzie when he was in his 80s about Thurman, he said that whenever they would have a meal and they would have a lobster, Thurman would always say he never could get over not eating fish, and so he'd always have a prolonged kind of moment of silence over the lobster to thank God for the lobster's life. And so it wasn't a joke, but it was like, you know, I know I probably shouldn't be eating this, but I love it so much, so we just want to really be honoring the lobster right now. Yeah. So it was very practical for him, you know, right? So what I want to close with, and you can leave now if you'd like, is it's just about 10 minutes. It's just a brief audio tape of Thurman doing a little reflection on a reading from one of the centering pieces, and then he's talking about it in terms of the import of just a natural generosity, kind of at the pattern of our daily lives rather than any institutional doing of goodwill. So we're just listening to this really quick.
Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart Be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. In a newspaper clipping that appeared in 1896 in Cincinnati, here is something that I'm reading as a background for our meditation. In a pottery factory here, there is a workman who had one small invalid child at home. He wrought at his trade with exemplary fidelity, being always in the shop with the opening of the day. He managed, however, to bear each evening to the bedside of his wee lad, as he called him, a flower, a bit of ribbon, or a fragment of crimson glass, indeed anything that would lie out on the white counterpane and give color to the room. He was a quiet, unsentimental man, but never went home at night without something that would make the wan face light up with joy at his return. He never said to a living soul that he loved that boy so much. Still, he went on patiently loving him. And by, he moved that whole shop into positively real but unconscious fellowship with him. The workmen made curious little jars and cups upon their wheels, and painted diminutive pictures down their sides before they stuck them in the corners of the kiln at burning time. One brought some fruit in the bulge of his apron, and another engravings on a rude scrapbook. Not one of them whispered a word, for this solemn thing was not to be talked about. They put them in the old man's hat where he found them. He understood all about it, and believe it or not, cynic as you may be, but it is a fact that the entire pottery, full of man of rather coarse fiber by nature, grew quiet as the months drifted, becoming gentle and kind, and some dropped swearing as the weary look on the patient fellow worker's face told them beyond mistake that the inevitable shadow was drawing nearer. Every day now, someone did a piece of work for him and put it on the sanded plank to dry so that he could come later and go earlier. So, when the bell tolled and the little coffin came out of the lonely door, right around the corner, out of sight, there stood 100 stalwart working men from the pottery with their clean clothes on, most of whom gave a half day's time for the privilege of taking part in the simple procession and following to the grave that small burden of a child, which probably not one of them had ever seen. One of the most precious sentences from the lips of the Master is this sentence: whosoever giveth a cup of cold water only will not lose his reward. The idea of giving a simple thing at a point of need, a cup of cold water. Two things to which I would call your attention about this. First, the cup itself. Now, the cup may be a tin cup, it may be a Dresden china cup, it may be a silver chalice, but the cup is the manner, the way in which it is done. It is the quality of the mood of sharing. You've had someone say to you, good morning. And then after such a salutation and the way it was said, you feel worse than you did before. You've had someone else say good morning, and to your surprise, it seems as if it is a good morning. And the difference is in the cup, the way, the mood. You've had someone do a favor for you, and when you received it, even though you needed it, it came at a time of desperate need on your part, yet there was something about it that made you feel as if it would have been much better if the person had withheld it. And you've had, on other occasions, someone to give you something, and you felt that in the giving, so much of themselves was shared that you felt that there was more to you as a result of it. The need was met, but something more than the need, something in you was touched thereby. It is said about Lowell that he was killed in the war, and he danced with all the girls at the party with whom no other fellows would dance. This is the idea. Even in the matter of giving the cup of cold water to the pets that you have, the animals that you have, there's a line over a dairy in Wisconsin which says, treat the cow as if she were a lady. This is the notion, this cup of cold water, the way, the mood, the manner in which it is done. Now, the cold water itself, it's sympathy, it's the quality of the thing itself, not what it's worth in money, not how it may be measured by some external standard or rule, but the thing itself becomes sacramental. It becomes a symbol of the very essence of generosity and graciousness. As a matter of fact, it takes a special kind of gift, and in my language, a special kind of gift of the spirit to be able to give something to someone in such a manner that the person will be able to forgive you for being in a position to help them. It is this quality.
So he goes on with that a little bit, just to talk really about the intentionality and the way we give. And I think that's an important thing to say in the final anecdote. You might know that Martin King Jr., before he was assassinated in the late 1960s, also was stabbed in New York during the time of his speaking. And he was hospitalized for some time just for recovering from that. And Thurman was able to go up and see him in New York while he was hospitalized recovering from being stabbed. And Thurman was aware that the handlers of King, while his friends would really want to get him back out there and to not miss some of the deadlines and some of the commitments. And so Thurman really conveyed to Martin King Jr., he said, you know, my advice to you is that your handlers are going to want to get you going, and I will speak to your doctors, or you can speak to your doctors and tell them to tell your handlers that you need another day or two simply to rest your mind, to rest your soul. He said, the long duration of your work, the time that you'll miss in terms of missing a couple stops to speak, this time of rest, of inner search, of kind of leisure, is what God needs for you, rather than getting right back out there and into it, the meditation, the rest. And so again, the pause, right? And so what I wanted to offer you here was two readings to take with you, so that if I see you Wednesday, it's great, and if I never see you again, I've left you something else of Thurman. These are both from the Inward Journey, which is a collection of centering pieces. One is called Squads of Emotion, and he's building on T.S. Eliot's four quartets and talking about undisciplined squads of emotion and how important our spiritual life it is that we get a hold of our emotions and integrate them into our prayer rather than let them confound our prayer. We don't want to be manic, we want to be organized in our prayer. And then the second one is called the idol of togetherness. And he was talking about especially in the collective times of the 20th century to where movements and tribalisms that we would call now kind of define who we were, that it's really important as religious individuals, even while we're congregationally bound, to be able to stand on our own as individuals before God and to not look to a community to define us. So some brief excerpts to take with you on your walks.
Great.
Thanks for your time, and I'll see you at supper. Thanks very much.
Thank you.